Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to These Football Times. Looking at some of the great, the not so great, the memorable and maybe even not so memorable games over the last few years. Today we're talking FA Cup finals. We've been for a sing-along with Chaz and Dave. We've been measured up for our suits. And I'm glad to say that looking resplendent in his white suit, like the Spice Boy white suit, is author, writer Dave Bowler. Good evening or good day, Dave. Welcome to Cup Final Day.
Good evening. I've never had a white suit in my entire life, I can promise you. Hard to be starting now.
and over in crossing the Severn Bridge, as sometimes the Welsh clubs do, and they've got a decent record in the FA Cup. So coming over from the west, we've got Reese Richards. Hello, Reese.
Good evening.
Cup Final Day.
Thank you very much. I've been up since 7 a.m. I've been on BBC Breakfast.
I saw you. Very good. Yeah.
Doing the rounds, just biding my time until the kickoff now.
Absolutely. And wouldn't it be great if we could all be joined by the TV cameras and it's a cup final, it's a knockout, a game of snooker, a question of sport. Great times, great times. And then the given celebrity of the day sprints across the pitch and scores into an empty goal to hurrahs and cheers from the crowd. Anyway, we haven't got time for that. We haven't even got time for a bide with me. We're going to crack on. We've shook hands with the Royal Dignitary. Well, I sort of nodded. You can shake hands with them if you like. And we're going to start with Reese. Reese, let's come to you first. Tell us about your first FA Cup final this evening. And I believe... had this recording actually been that cup final, we'd have missed the first goal by now. So tell us about your first match tonight.
Great. So this was the Chelsea-Middlesbrough final in 97, a very memorable one started early. Nobody wasted any time, particularly Roberto Di Matteo in this game. But I'll get to that in a minute. What I wanted to talk about was, you know, as a football romantic, I tend to support the team going into the final, or into any game really, that I think has the best narrative. And for this one, both teams had great stories going in. So it was an incredible time for Middlesbrough in the 90s. Player manager Brian Robson had taken them up into the Premier League. And this season is when they were boasting their really high profile internationals. So they had Emerson from Brazil, Juninho, who went on to be probably their best, most famous player of the era, and Fabrizio Ravanelli, who I couldn't explain the logic here, but left Champions League winners Juventus to join Middlesbrough in the Northeast as part of this, I guess, really exciting project. But how incredible was that at the time? You know, we saw some stars coming over around this era in the Premier League, but to see the number nine striker of the Champions League winners join was really really exciting. Imagine being a fan of the Northeast at the time. Really mad season for Middlesbrough because they reached both domestic cup finals, yet somehow managed to get relegated in the same season. Well, I say somehow, it was due to some really awful admin or an awful decision on their part. So around Christmas time, they had a fixture to fulfil against Blackburn, which they reneged on. They said they couldn't provide a team for the final, for the game, sorry, and got deducted 3 points as a result. Now, they could have lost the game 10-0 with youth players and not been relegated. So it just shows how awful a decision that was. And then from the other side, you've got Chelsea, who were, again, in quite a romantic era. So they bought some great foreign players, some good domestic ones as well. Mark Hughes from Man United, great Gianfranco Zola, Gianluca Vialli, and Roberto Di Matteo as well, making this kind of a cosmopolitan, really fashionable Chelsea team. So they were like the 1970s Kings of the Kings Road era. It's probably the last time the Chelsea were fashionable and probably the last time the Chelsea were likeable as well. So I guess 97 doesn't feel like that long ago, but if you describe Chelsea as a likeable football club, then, you know, it feels like a different era. They also had something hanging over them Chelsea. So tragically, going into or earlier in the season, their vice chairman Matthew Harden was killed in a helicopter crash, and it felt like the season itself was Chelsea's attempt. Everything they were trying to do was an attempt to pay tribute to Matthew Harding, because he was extremely influential in the development of the club, to going from, you know, Chelsea of the early 90s to, you know, eventually the Chelsea we know now. He really butted heads with Ken Bates, the owner. Absolutely polar opposites. So Matthew Harding was Mr. New Labour, a Blairite, a bit of a yuppie. Came from money, whereas Ken Bates was a council house kid who turned into a Tory. Totally different ends of the political spectrum, hated each other. And, you know, they were really in battle for control of the club. There's a great documentary, actually, on BT Sports called Poundland, about the battle for Stamford Bridge. Tragically, it would all end with Matthew Harding's death. And, yeah, that was hanging over Chelsea going into the final. But, you know, they blew the cobwebs away in really spectacular fashion. Really early into the game with Di Matteo after 42 seconds. So I think he catches everyone cold, really, because the strike is an incredible strike. So it's a 30 yarder, a dip in strike that goes over the keeper's fingertips. But I guess he was thinking 40 seconds of the game, nobody's going to shoot. Clips the underside of the crossbar. It's an absolutely brilliant goal. And then what could have been maybe an incredible final. The better side in Chelsea kind of control the game then and just keep Middlesbrough at arm's length. I think it's Ramon Vega who has a goal disallowed controversially. And then it's Eddie Newton who, famous for a long stint at Cardiff City. Just going to get my first Cardiff City reference in there. Famous for a long stint. He gets the second goal. It's a great, it's not quite a back heel, but it's a cushioned heel assist across the 6 yard box by Zola. Obviously the best player on the field. You know, maybe the best player in the league at the time. Everyone gravitates towards Zola. He just cushions the ball to Eddie Newton, sends everyone the wrong way, and Newton finishes easily. And it's Ruud Gullit's Chelsea manager, his debut silverware for Chelsea.
I think that one of the things that strikes me is that this felt like the first hurrah of that Chelsea team. I know the team evolved when Abramovich came in. Obviously, Ranieri came in just before Abramovich, but I remember Chelsea in the 94 Cup final and they played Man United and they were absolutely battered. United won the Cup double. They lost 4-0. But this Chelsea team always seemed to be on the cusp of something. And it turns out that it didn't quite get there in the league, but it had something about it. I mean, you used the word likeable and I would agree with that. It felt like, well, they're not going to win the league, but, you know, they're a good flamboyant team to watch. It's the place you go if you're starstruck, new football fan, maybe being taken up by his mom or dad. You want to get a couple of autographs. You've got these superstars coming from West London. And yet they never quite got over the line in the league. It needed another cycle of players to come through. Dave, what are your memories of this? One of the most astonishing things for this, from this final, is that Roberto Di Matteo has magnificent hair, which I do not remember him having hair like that. It was something else.
It was obviously before he took up smoking constantly, like a chimney. that's my abiding memory of Roberto Di Matteo. He's a never-ending search for a fag after every game of football. That's another story. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, they were a likeable outfit at that time. It was all the glamour. I mean, Ruud Gullit carried a lot of class with him, and, you know, I think everybody warmed to Ruud Gullit at that point, and he was going to bring sexy football to the masses and all that kind of stuff. And, yeah, to be likeable when you've got Ken Bates. I mean, if Matthew Harding was New Labour, Ken Bates was Lee Anderson. I mean, you know. Yeah, the bloke who wanted to electrify the fences around Stamford Bridge, and somehow Ruud Gullit makes the football club likeable. I mean, that's shifting some, isn't it? But they were an entertaining team. Glenn Hoddle obviously started things off when he went there as manager, and then Gullit carried it on. And, you know, he was the first foreign manager to win the FA Cup, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. Seems remarkable now, given that virtually every manager who gets the cup final seems to be foreign. So, you know, it's.
Well, on that note, we are going to talk about the last English manager to win the FA Cup final shortly. So it's a relevant point that this is the this is the kind of first cycle of football really changing in this country, where we've had the money coming in from the Premier League, the Champions League is becoming this huge monster, and the FA Cup is maybe being chipped away somewhat. And we're going to see huge chunks of the FA Cup chipped away when Man United withdraw in 2000. But this felt like an era where we were starting to see change in English football. We were starting to see the superstars coming to this team. So rather than players like, you know, Robert Vasheha at Everton or Anders Limpo at Arsenal, who are decent European players, we were now getting superstars coming over. Viali, Zola, Gullit, Dave.
Made a complete, you know, it was the beginning of a revolution, wasn't it? I think in the way that we watch football, the way that we consume it, the way we think about it, the way it was played over here. I mean, you know, I'm not of the view that, you know, we've never had possession football in this country, because, you know, we had. But Chelsea in particular, when Hoddle came in and playing with that back three and five in the midfield, it was all about keeping hold of the ball. And that's what they did so well against Middlesbrough in this game. I mean, Middlesbrough, you know, they didn't have their troubles to seek, as they say. I mean, you know, Ravinelli got... He went into the game with an injury and he was off after 20-odd minutes. Robbie Musto was off after half an hour. So they'd lost two players in the first half an hour. And Chelsea just wouldn't let them have the ball. They wouldn't let them get into the game. Once Di Matteo had scored that goal early on, it's not one-way traffic, but it was a very controlled performance from Chelsea. And I remember watching the game and never, apart from the disallowed goal that Middlesbrough had, I never really felt that they were going to get back into the game. It was just one of those. That was Chelsea sort of making a statement that they were, you know, a coming team properly in English football. Because you say that FA Cup final 3 years earlier against Manchester United, I mean, they'd been absolutely wiped out in that game. And this, you know, this was a wholly different Chelsea by then.
Rhys, I'm intrigued by Middlesbrough here, because Brian Robson has come in a few years earlier, led a revolution from the growth of the club when what was then the Cellnex Stadium, or what we call now the Riverside, opened. And it'd be interesting to hear your view as an appraisal of Brian Robson's time as Middlesbrough manager, because this was a really bizarre season. You rightly point out that game against Blackburn that he could not field a team. And, you know, Dave and I know Brian to some degree, and that is the most un-Robson-esque thing that any Brian Robson team would do, not be available to play a game because of the kind of competitor he was as a footballer. Yet here he was, he lost his points, they were relegated, yet they still got to two cup finals. Overall, how do you appraise, Rhys, how do you appraise Brian Robson's time as Middlesbrough manager against the backdrop of this particular final, especially?
It's interesting that I agree with you there. It's totally at odds with him as a character. He's a player who played most of his career with some injury hanging over him. You know, the way he would fly in tackles, you know, leg breakers, risking those, and then to not field the team, yeah, it seems almost like the coward's way out. Like, why wouldn't you send youth players out there? Why wouldn't you put some kind of team out? And obviously, the results were disastrous. I guess if you know, following promotion, I guess your objective is survival, but it's always a risk. I mean, any team that goes into the Premier League, they're always the favourites to go down, even with the vast expenditure with bringing those names in. So I guess there was a degree of, if not inevitability, but I guess there was always a possibility of that. I mean, it depends what you want as a fan, doesn't it? Would you choose the journey to two cup finals, the potential to win one of them? I think I'd rather support a team that maybe has its alliances with the promotion and relegation, but gets the cup finals. I think maybe this is me as the romantic. I think winning cups or just being in the race, being in the journey is far more exciting than the rigmarole of the league, because, you know, 70% of the time the league season is incredibly boring. So I think being a Middlesbrough fan, not that I was, but I can imagine being a Middlesbrough fan at that time is probably one of the most exciting times to support the club.
They did indeed get to the League Cup final that following year, losing to Chelsea 2-0. Di Matteo scoring again, and Frank Sinclair incredibly scoring as well for Chelsea. So, they were a bit of a bogey team for Middlesbrough around this point. But, Dave, this particular final, it kind of killed the occasion, that early goal, didn't it? And it never really lived up to some of the finals that maybe we'd seen earlier on in the decade or in the previous decade. And was the FA Cup at this point already now starting to show signs of decay against the growth of what we were seeing coming into the Premier League, what we were seeing coming into European football, etc., etc.?
I'm not so sure necessarily quite at this point, but it was that change was beginning to come. I mean, yeah, I remember this one still being a big occasion and lots of talk in the week ahead about would Ravenelli play or wouldn't he, you know, all that kind of stuff. And this is how Middlesbrough are going to salvage their season, even though they've been relegated and all that kind of stuff. So it was still a big deal. You know, the country stopped still for the FA Cup at that point, I think. I mean, it didn't take much longer before that started to go away, and obviously the Manchester United thing, as you say, not taking part in the competition made a big difference. I think that was one of the big things. And I suppose it was really when the Champions League got really bloated that started to kill it off. That really began to overtake everything. But I think this was still, you know, quite a big occasion, made more so, you know, by Middlesbrough being there, who were a team that hadn't been in cup finals and that kind of stuff. And, you know, going back to the Brian Robson thing, for all that it ended in relegation and stuff, that period when they got promoted this season, then the following season they got to another cup final, that was when Middlesbrough started to emerge as a team that were in the running for things. Mm. Okay, they didn't win anything until Steve McLaren turned up, did they? But, you know, there was a belief that they could get into the final stages of cup competitions and, you know, be a serious player. And that takes some doing, you know, when you think that, was it 86 that they nearly went out of business? You know, they closed the gates on Ayrton Park and all of that stuff. So, I mean, you know, within a decade, here they are playing in an FA Cup final. You know, that's as we're forced to call it nowadays, some journey. And, you know, and Robson's got a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, rightly so. I mean, it felt like a revolution, much like the Chelsea periods was one of maybe change and a shifting from the parochial West London club where you could park cars behind the goal. All of a sudden, they were growing into this huge entity. And Middlesbrough went a similar way. You know, they emerged from 1986. Steve Gibson created this club to challenge, to be the number one club in the Northeast. And they never quite got there, but they really did give it their best shot, Reece.
Yeah, on the Casper, it's such a... Oh, I'm going to send the cliché-ometer into overdrive here. I'm not going to say magic the cup, but I am going to mention a hotbed of football, which I guess everywhere seems to be, but the Northeast, yeah, obviously with Sunderland and Newcastle up there as well, it's just, yeah, threatened to become a big player up there, but yeah, these things are hard to sustain, and I think that's the overarching thing, isn't it? They managed to get to these cup finals, but to sustain over a long period of time, you know, that wasn't achievable for them.
Well, we've had the 1997 FA Cup final. Dave, I think you're going to take us a little bit further back. We haven't got sponsors on shirts in this game. We might not even have colour TV in this game. In fact, I'm fairly sure we haven't got colour TV. Tell us about the cup final you've chosen.
Well, the first one is 1953. Not that I remember it, I hasten to add. But I did think somebody ought to talk about 1953. Not just because, you know, I mean, it's the Matthews final. Everybody knows the whole story of the Matthews final. There he was, Stanley Matthews, the David Beckham of his day, probably the most celebrated sportsman in the country, perhaps the best-known footballer in the world at that point. 38, twice an FA Cup loser. Never won the winner's medal. And at that time in particular, getting that FA Cup winner's medal was the pinnacle of a player's career. You know, your career wasn't complete unless you'd won the FA Cup. And obviously at 38, people thought time was running out for Stanley Matthews, who then went on and played for about another 12 years. But, you know, this was seen as his final chance against Bolton Wanderers. I mean, I won't go through the game because everybody knows all the stuff. But Bolton ahead after 90 seconds, 3-1 up with 20 odd minutes to go, Bolton have even managed to score a goal with a fella called called Bell, who had got injured, torn his hamstring in the first half. In the days without substitutes, he couldn't go off, so he was just hopping down the left wing, basically. Somehow found himself in the middle of the box when the cross came in and headed it in for 3-1. And at this point, Stanley Matthews hasn't done anything. You know, it's a complete damp squib. He's done nothing. He's going to be a loser again. Then 68 minutes, he turns the fullback into their crosses and Stan Mortensen scores. Nothing else happens until the last 2 minutes of the game. Blackpool get a free kick on the edge of the box. Stanley Mortensen smashes it in from 25 yards. Now, this is a hat-trick for Stanley Mortensen. Only the third ever FA Cup final hat-trick. The first one's in 1894. The first one ever at Wembley. And some other bugger gets the cup final named after him. If I was Stan Mortensen, I'd be a bit cheesed off, frankly, that this isn't the Mortensen final. But anyway, 2 minutes into added time, which was as much as you used to get in those days. You didn't get half an hour like you do now. Stanley Matthews again skips into the box, pulls the ball back. Bill Perry scores, 4-3. Matthews final, Blackpool have won, the Queen's there. That's all great. It was a great game, a fantastic finish in particular. But, I mean, the reason I've chosen this is the game that creates the FA Cup final as we know it. It was the first one to be televised live. And it was televised live because, topically, the coronation was just around the corner. It was a month before the Queen had the coronation. And, of course, as a result of that, the nation had gone television crazy and all of a sudden people were buying and renting television sets. So people actually had these things in their homes, or at least there were probably one or two in the street and everybody could huddle around it and watch these, you know, shimmering black and white images coming across live from Wembley Stadium. And also it was a bit of a dry run for the coronation itself in that it was a live broadcast, live outside broadcast. They wanted to make sure all this kind of stuff was working. The magic of the cup is that on that day, it turned out, not only was it the first one that was televised, but it turned out to be this game that, you know, has gone down the ages because of Stanley Matthews and the losing 3-2 with 2 minutes to go, ending up winning 4-3. It captured the imagination of the country. Now, while that game was going on, there was also a programme of normal league fixtures on that day because the cup final at that point wasn't the culmination of the season. Often it was played the week before the end of the season. Everybody else was playing their league games and then you'd have another league, set of league matches the week after. This, because it was such a huge hit with the public, it had everything. Now the FA Cup final was always going to be televised live thereafter. And that was what began, you know, the real concentration, I think. I mean, everybody at that point loved the FA Cup. It was always the biggest thing for a player. But this took it into another level, the television, the coverage of it. And then ultimately, as you say, you know, we moved into the 60s and the 70s and it was on both channels of BBC One and ITV and it all kicked off at 9 o'clock in the morning and, you know, it was wall-to-wall FA Cup final all day long. You know, you couldn't get away from it. And that one game and that one day transformed the FA Cup and I suppose led to, you know, it was the beginning of televising football as we know it now. So in that sense, it was, you know, probably the single most significant FA Cup final that there's been. You could argue 1923, the White Horse final, I suppose. But I think in terms of, you know, mass coverage and taking the game into people's homes, this was the one that started it. So although I didn't see it, this has got to be in there.
Well, Stan Mortensen, obviously, like all players from that team, has passed away. And there was talk that his funeral was going to be known as a Stanley Matthews funeral. Sadly, that wasn't to happen. But, I mean, Reece, none of us remember this game. But I think Dave's touched upon something interesting about the whole notion of the FA Cup final being this celebration of football, that we maybe have lost sight of that. But at this point, this was the game that probably opened that particular gate. I think the following year we had a 3-2 to West Brom. against Preston. The year after that, there was another relatively high-scoring game. This was a sort of festival of football that seemed the perfect way to end a football season. Have we lost a little bit of sight of that now, in that we don't give it that same bit of kudos?
I think what we suffer from is the oversaturation of football. I mean, it is everywhere, isn't it? You can watch any game from anywhere in the world pretty much whenever you want. I still think there's a certain draw, a certain appeal. Maybe it's my age. I remember a time before all this. So when I grew up, football was pretty much a broadcast sport for me. I didn't go to many football games as a young boy. But the FA Cup final was that focal point at the end of the season, like you're saying. I watched a lot of Serie A. The early days of the Premier League kind of passed me by. It would be Serie A on the weekend, Scorio, the Welsh language, highlight show on a Monday night, and then in May, the FA Cup final. I think there's still a little something to it. So it's that appointment television, they call it. So now we live in an era of Netflix, and you can stream whatever you want, and we consume things differently. But I found myself watching the Brighton Man United semi-final simply because it was on BBC, and I felt drawn to it. I felt like I had to watch that game. Now, if that league fixture is on BT Sport, I probably won't watch it. I wouldn't have that interest in it. But the FA Cup still has that kind of mythology to it, and I think a lot of it is maybe just. Is just built on mythology. So it reminded me, you know, Dave's tells a story brilliantly there of Stanley Matthews becoming in some ways football's first recognizable football star, because there's a, like you said, there's a full fixture list going on, but there's one that's being televised, and it coincides, like you say, with the coronation. That's gonna stay in people's memories. It reminds me slightly of an anecdote I added in my book about the 78 World Cup, where people misremember buying colour televisions in Argentina with the 1978 World Cup final. Now, the game wasn't transmitted in colour in Argentina in 1978, but if you speak to an Argentine, they will tell you, yeah, I went down to Fravega, the store, I bought the TV, and I watched the World Cup final in colour. Never happened. So I think other people will have that same story maybe about Stanley Matthews. Mm. I think if most people ask their grandparents or great-grandparents, maybe they'll say that they were the first people on the street to own a TV. Almost every person of a certain age I've met has that claim. They can't all be the first family on the street to have owned a TV, but that's the kind of thing. And these moments just build up that mythology. And yeah, they really, I think the final is the showcase, and the showcase makes the stars. And, you know, who bigger in the era than Stanley Matthews? He actually goes on to get European Football of the Year, I think, a few years later, or maybe it is that year, beating Alfredo Di Stefano for it. So, you know, doesn't get much bigger than that.
Dave, this game and the fact that it coincides with coronation year is quite interesting, and the fact that it was used as a little bit of a petri dish as to how live TV might work. If this game ends like the previous years does, a 1-0 victory, Newcastle beating Arsenal in 1952, which way does that maybe become a sliding doors moment for the FA Cup, or do you think that this was just that perfect storm and it wouldn't have mattered really how this game finished? It was always going to be regarded as this event that drew in communities, drew in people, drew in families to watch this one sporting event every year.
I think the big thing is, you know, once television can do something, it'll do it. So once they proved that they could do live coverage of a football match in this way, they were always going to carry on doing it. I think what this did was make this the occasion. This was, you know, the FA Cup final became the thing that you couldn't possibly miss. It was the, you know, the most important football match of the year. It was, I mean, at that point, they did actually bizarrely used to show schoolboy internationals live on television. I mean, there must have been a big crowd for that. But this was the one that sort of propelled everything forward. And I think, you know, it's the nature of that game, you know. Any game where the team's winning with 2 minutes to go and ends up losing is a memorable thing. You know, the Manchester United Champions League win and that kind of stuff. Those things go down in legend, because there's no better way of winning a game of football than coming from behind with 5 minutes to go and you come out and won it. I mean, you always remember that kind of stuff. I think, you know, the biggest thing about this was the turning it into the showpiece, and I think that was a good thing for football. It just seems to me that a football season is more satisfying if it ends in one game. Whereas if you know, like, they changed it around and yeah, they moved it again so that the Premier League would be the last weekend of the season. Well, if everybody's playing at the same time, there's no sense of occasion, is there? Because, you know, you're at your game if you've gone to the game, or you're watching Sky or BT or whatever, and trying to keep abreast of 10 different matches at once. That's not an occasion where the FA Cup final wasn't just the FA Cup final. It was kind of the celebration of the season, and you know, the season's over. We've all had a good time, haven't we? And now we're going to have this one big blowout bash to finish it off before we all come back in 3 months' time. And you know, I think that was an important sort of full stop on the season at that point. And you know, it's going to be the last game again this season. I think that's a really strong way to end the campaign, I think.
Yeah, long may that tradition continue. And indeed, given it's another coronation year, maybe Man United, Man City might serve us up something special. Let's wait and see. Now, I'm going to talk about Man United. I'm going to take us back to 1990 for my first match. This was an incredible final in so many ways. I always think of cup finals as being, there are two fulfillments for it to be a memorable final. You need either a very good football match or you need a very good story to emerge. So for instance, Liverpool versus Wimbledon wasn't a great game, but the big story was Wimbledon won. Coventry City Tottenham fulfilled both of those. Now this particular match also fulfilled both of those in many respects. And it would have done either way had Palace won the game. And Man United won the game after a replay. Now, the first game ebbed and flowed. It was a brilliantly shiny, sunny day at Wembley. Gary O'Reilly scored the opening goal just inside 20 minutes before Brian Robson equalised. And it was a decent game. You know, it's nothing particularly special at that point in the first half, but it was a decent game. And then Mark Hughes, having returned from Bayern Munich and Barcelona, scored United second. And then Crystal Palace bring on Ian Wright. Ian Wright's been injured for most of this particular half of the campaign. He's had a broken leg. He comes on, and in the 72nd minute, which was literally 3 minutes after coming on, he scores Palace's second. So the game ends 2-2. We go into extra time. Ian Wright scores within 2 minutes of the game resuming, and everything's looking set up for Crystal Palace win. We've got the great game. We've got the great story. Ian Wright returning from a broken leg, going to win Crystal Palace their first ever cup final. But not quite, because Mark Hughes, who's somebody we mentioned earlier, he's on fire, a big game player, and absolutely nailed on 8 or 9 out of 10 in every cup final he plays for Manchester United during this period. Scores his second and United's third, 3-3. But something happens in this match. Something significant happens that I think was to define Sir Alex Ferguson's time at Manchester United. This was a period when Alex Ferguson, before he was Sir, was being maligned. There was talk of him not surviving the season, talk of him being sacked. And between that Saturday of the cup final, when they drew 3-3, and the replay on the Thursday, he made probably one of the most defining decisions, in my view, of his managerial career at Man United. He dropped his goalkeeper. Jim Leighton had been absolutely dismal in this particular campaign. Jim Leighton was a good goalkeeper, served Aberdeen superbly when Ferguson was there, came to United and found the pressure a little bit too much. And this was an expensively assembled United team. Gary Pallister had come in, Michael Phelan, Paul Ince had come in for nearly 2 million. Neil Webb came in and got injured for England on England duty within four games of his debut. So this was a real period of pressure for Alex Ferguson. But in that one decision, on that Thursday, he decided to drop his number one goalkeeper and bring in a journeyman loanee called Les Seeley. Les Seeley was a good goalkeeper, but as I said on the just a moment ago, he was a journeyman. He was a decent goalkeeper, no more. And he had one of the games of his life to help Man United to a 1-0 victory, with the fullback Lee Martin scoring following a brilliant raking ball by Neil Webb. But that significant moment of dropping Jim Leighton was to define Ferguson, because his number two was Archie Knox, who was a big ally of Jim Leighton's, as Ferguson had been until that point. And Archie Knox was absolutely batting for Jim Leighton to be given one last chance in that replay. Ferguson said no. Manchester United won. Les Seeley had an outstanding game. And this was to become the first trophy that Manchester United were to win throughout the next 20 however many years on Sir Alex Ferguson's watch. The following year came the Cup Winners' Cup. They got to the League Cup final. Following year after that, they did win the League Cup final, finished second in the league. And beyond that, in the first Premier League, they won that. And we know what happened next and everything that followed. I think this was possibly Fergie's not greatest moment, but maybe the most pivotal, or one of the most pivotal moments of his managerial career. Rhys?
Sounds incredibly significant, doesn't it, when you put it like that? I think, yeah, I've often heard this referenced as that sliding doors moment of, you know, had they lost, what would have happened? I think, you know, reading between the lines as well from what you said there, this is a moment where I guess maybe Fergie's authority becomes unquestionable there. He's made that decision. And not a decision he would have taken lightly as well. If you look at the great sides he assembled, the two European Cup winning teams, they both started with a really solid goalkeeper. So you've got Schmeichel and Edwin van der Sar. So to change a goalkeeper and to also have the man management to know what that's going to do to a dressing room and manage that. And then to come out the other side, it would have been an incredibly significant moment for him, and I guess a great win.
Dave, this final, we spoke about Brian Robson earlier, managing Middlesbrough to two cup finals in one year with the League Cup final. This felt like not a final hurrah for Robson, because he did go on for a few more years, but he was to become the first man to captain three FA Cup teams or FA Cup sides to victory. And yet, had things gone a little bit differently in that first game at Wembley, we could have been talking about people like Alan Pardew, God forbid, being FA Cup heroes.
Yeah, well, every story has a silver lining. The silver lining, this is Alan Pardew lost. That's what makes it a memorable game, isn't it? Memorable game isn't a 4-0. It's one of those that's on a knife edge and could go either way. I mean, I remember, again, you know, we were talking about the Ravanelli thing before the Chelsea-Middlesbrough final. It was the same with Ian Wright, or to give him his full name, Ian Wright, right. Before that cup final, you know, it was all, is he going to play? Is he going to start? All of that kind of stuff. And obviously he had a point to prove, because he wasn't best pleased at being a sub. And he had a point to prove when he came on. He scored, you know, I remember Motson saying, shades of Ricky Villa when he scored the first one. Yeah, it was a great goal, and it was a really good cup final, that. But as you say, the Jim Leighton thing is defining, not just because they went on and won that replay, but I think in Ferguson's own mind, it confirmed that you've got to be absolutely ruthless. I mean, yeah, Jim Leighton was the only man he'd brought with him from Aberdeen. I mean, Strachan was already there, and he didn't get on with Strachan. That's another story. But Jim Leighton was the one he brought from Aberdeen. He was, you know, the chosen one kind of thing that he'd taken with him. To drop him and to go against Archie Knox, believe me, I know a bit about Archie Knox, and you don't disagree with him lightly. That, you know, that it did prove his authority, but I think it proved to himself, right, I'm going to live or die by what I think is the right thing. You know, and you look how quickly he dispensed with Yap Stam, how quickly he dispensed with Paul Ince or, you know, Beckham. Or, you know, nobody was ever bigger, allowed to be bigger than the team. And he was always willing to make that decision right at that point. And I think, you know, all of that stems from the Jim Leighton thing. Okay, if Les Healy hadn't made those saves, then perhaps it would have been a different story. He wouldn't have got the chance. But I think the fact that he was proven right. I mean, obviously Alex Ferguson was never short of confidence. You know, that's part of his great skill set. But I think that just reinforced his belief in himself and his belief in what he was doing and the way he saw the game. So I think, yeah, that cup final was one of the, not just a cup final, but one of the single most significant football games in English football over the last sort of 40, 50 years, I think.
Mm. And of course, Reece, as Dave alludes to, if Les Seeley comes in and has an absolute stinker, history goes a completely different way, and we might not have Sir Alex Ferguson, merely Alex Ferguson, the guy who didn't win a single trophy at Old Trafford.
That's it, isn't it? Those are the that's why they get paid the big bucks, I guess. Those are those huge decisions. I think so much of it we don't see. Like we have no idea what goes on the training ground. We don't really know about the interpersonal relationships. What we can criticise, and what we do criticise more than anything else, is selection. So as soon as he's made that decision, he's really, you know, he's out there, he's gone over the top, he's, you know, he's fair game for whatever comes. And obviously it's massive for him that he gets that, and, you know, he never looks back, as we know. But yeah, if you get that decision wrong, you know, that could have been the job.
Reece, before we move on, I just want to get the final word from you about a compatriot of yours, a player who I believe was probably one of the most underrated footballers of this generation. I've mentioned him already, Mark Hughes. He was just the big, big time player. You know, I honestly believe if Wales had ever got to a tournament final, he would have delivered, because he had that. He had that ability to just evolve as a footballer and that big game temperament that not every footballer possesses, but is a great skill to have.
Absolutely. I was worried for a second when you were giving us the underdog narrative about Crystal Palace. I thought you were trying to paint him as the villain. I wasn't going to sound rigorous. But yeah, he's incredible, isn't he? If you look at the pantheon of Welsh greats, I think as a striker, he's got to be up there. And he, you know, he kept on playing, and that level, that authority, the way he carried himself when he went to Chelsea, you know, well beyond his best after his second stint at Man U, he was such an influential player at Chelsea. He kept Gianluca Vialli out of the team. You know, if you want to go back to my 97 cup final, one of the most significant games in that run is the third round 4-2 winning against Liverpool. They come from behind at Stamford Bridge, and Vialli comes off the bench with I guess the two winning goals. But Mark Hughes is absolutely incredible in that game, and he is that big game player. And I guess, you know, when you've got players like that in your team, you've always got more than half a chance.
Absolutely. We're going to keep it in Wales for the next game, Reece. Tell us about your next choice.
Yeah, now I could have gone all the way back to 1927 for the for Cardiff's triumph. I could tell you.
I'm so glad you didn't.
No. I would alienate, you know, everywhere west of Bridgend on the M4. I could tell you the story of why Cardiff have triangular flags and Swansea have rectangular flags, but you'll have to watch the movie Twin Town for that. I'm going to be a little bit more contemporary, and I'm going to talk about 2008, the Cardiff-Portsmouth final. This is another one where the journey is really significant for me here. So personally, I watched the semi-final, which this is a shame. It was at Wembley. We've got to go back to Villa Park. We've got to go back to the neutral grounds of the semis. I'm sure you'd all agree there. But this was a significant one. I wasn't at Wembley for it. I wasn't in Cardiff either. I watched this game at Swansea, Bryn Mawr Pub. In Swansea, and Joe Ledley scores the winner against Barnsley with a fantastic volley from the edge of the box. I hit the roof when he scored, and quickly found out that I was not no longer welcome in said pub, and I haven't been back since, but I'm sure it's still there. I watched the final then, again, not in Wembley or in Cardiff, in Butlin's Minehead, of all places. There was a music festival there created by a post-rock band called Explosions in the Sky. And I went from watching the semi-final in a place where everyone hated me to watching the final amongst hipsters with massive fringes where everyone hated football and nobody cared. So I was left to live with the despair of that on my own. An interesting time for both clubs. As I said, this is why I chose it, similar to the Chelsea-Middlesbrough game. It's a club where both teams have a really strong narrative going into it. So Cardiff of the era were very much the nearly men, one of the best teams in the Championship. Year on year, trouble in the playoffs. We lost a couple of playoffs, lost out on the playoffs a couple of times. It's just a great era. Looking at how unstable things are now at the club, it's really, I look back at those memories fondly. But the Cardiff team was, it's a legendary one. There's Joe Ledley, the last player from Cardiff to actually make it and play in the first team. There's a young Aaron Ramsey, who's actually from Caerphilly, near enough. On the bench, there's Callum McNaughton, Roger Johnson, legendary Peter Whittingham. And then leading the line, you've got two aging strikers in Hasselbank, Jimmy Floyd, and Robbie Fowler, who's actually injured for the final. And similar to Ravenelli, there was a whole will he, won't he make it. Dave Jones, fortunately this time, didn't select him. And yeah, Hasselbank was leading the line. So after all this, after all the build-up, I was actually quite a disappointing final, really. A 1-0 win for Portsmouth, where Nwankwo Kanu kind of bundles the ball into the back of the net. And this is probably the high point of Portsmouth's cycle. They were pretty much a boom and bust club. Redknapp's back at the club following his sabbatical at the biggest rival, Southampton, of all places. I think he just enjoyed living on the South Coast. Fell out with the Portsmouth board, came back. This is the high point for them, lifting that cup. And then you can't help that, the masochist in me can't help but wonder what might have happened. So obviously, had Cardiff won this, would have ended up in the UEFA Cup as it was then. And just looking at Portsmouth's route through it. I don't know why I'm doing this to myself. So first of all, they had a two-leg playoff against Vitória Guimarães from Portugal. And then in the group, they have Wolfsburg, Braga and Milan, of all places. So, had it not been for the intervention of Nwankwo Kanu, had it not been for, Portsmouth's highly expensive midfield of players like Lassana Diarra and who else would have been there at the time? Sully Montari. We could have been in the San Siro. Imagine that, Cardiff in the San Siro. To make it worse, Swansea went one step further when they won the League Cup. Still not a triumph for the GSU triangular flags, but they won the League Cup and went on their own incredible European tour where they played Valencia and Napoli. So you can't help but think what might have been for that. And I don't know if I want to pick at this wound, gentlemen, but I know you've both feel a case of what might have been, what happened in the other semi-final.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the UEFA Cup. I interviewed the West Brom owner or controlling shareholder in the week leading up to the semi-finals, Jeremy Peace, and he jokingly said that if West Brom were to get to the final and win, he would seek to withdraw West Brom from the European competition because the Europa League or UEFA Cup, as it was then, was a loss-making tournament. And he thought, well, we're not going to make any money on this, so why would we enter it? Not quite in the spirit of what any football owner should be saying, but I thought that was interesting. Of course, it wasn't a problem that we had to endure because, as we know, Dave and I know, Portsmouth were to beat West Brom in the semi-final. It was an interesting period, actually, because I remember driving down to Wembley for the other semi-final, as you put it, Rhys. I remember listening to Mike Parry saying that if West Brom were to get to the final and obviously play Barnsley or Cardiff, then the FA Cup would be dead. That would be it. The FA Cup should be shut down because there's no Premier League clubs in there and who wants to watch two Championship teams clogging it out? Notwithstanding the fact that particular West Brom team did anything but clog their way into winning positions, actually played some decent football. But it kind of summed up where football was going at that point. Dave, this Portsmouth team, to go back to the final, and I've got my little rant out the way there, to go back to the final, this Portsmouth team struck me as being one that was bought on the never-never, as we used to say back in the day.
Well, it was ultimately this Portsmouth team that, you know, saw the club virtually go out of business, didn't it? You know, years and years in the financial wilderness as a consequence. You know, you look at some of the names: David James, Sol Campbell, Glenn Johnson, you know, Milan Baroš, Kanu. You know, that side didn't come cheap in terms of wages.
Who was the midfielder who cost about 50 grand a week? I'm trying to remember his name.
Montari.
That was it. Yeah, that's it.
At the time as well.
I mean, you know, it was a team that was living beyond their means. I mean, you know, you go back 2 years to when Harry Redknapp went in to Portsmouth, and they were virtually on the way out of the Premier League. I mean, they're coming towards Christmas, they were nowhere. And then in the January, they spent an absolute fortune and survived. You know, fair enough. That's what football clubs do. No arguments with that. But obviously, it ultimately had the impact on Portsmouth as a football club. But they're still feeling. I mean, they're still in League One now. You know, they went all the way down and gradually sort of clawing their way back a bit now. But it's hard not to feel aggrieved from both our cases that we were beaten by a team that was living beyond its means. Though had it been us, who cares, frankly. So, you know, that's pure Sarah Grapes. I mean, the fascinating thing was Kanu, you know, scoring twice at the age of 67, you know, in the semi-finals and the final. I mean, Kanu, this is a terribly scurrilous story and I do apologise, but I'm going to tell it anyway. Kanu was nowhere... how he ever got a passport to say that he was the age he was, nobody knows. Because I seem to remember when he was at West Brom, Brian Robson used to say, we have to nurse Kanu through because of his age. His official age at the time was 27. the story at Arsenal was that they got rid of him because they'd done a bone density scan to discover what his real age was. And this bone density scan uncovered the fact that he was a Stegosaurus. but he was a remarkable footballer. I mean, I was just watching some of the highlights earlier on, and you know, some of the things that he could do with the football, the way he could manipulate it was just absolutely incredible. I mean, he was genuinely a world class footballer, and you know, in that sense, we both lost to Kanu goals. So I suppose, you know, you've been beaten by the very best. Not that that's a great deal of consolation to any of us, I don't suppose. But there you are.
I think it's redemption for Kanu after missing out on the 1955 European Player of the Year to Stanley Matthews.
I remember actually a guy called John Evans, Dr. John Evans, who was West Brom secretary for many years, calling me into his office at West Brom and saying, "Chris, you keep referring to Kanu's age," and I think he was 28 at this point. I said, "Yes, I do. He's 28." He said, "Do yourself a favour, stop talking about his age. We've got the paperwork. He's 7 years older." I was like, okay. Yes. And he said, "Oh, by the way, that's all off the record." And Dr. John sadly is no longer with us, so he can't, he can't have any recall from that. But it goes to prove really what a strange beast that was. And it was all down to the fact that there was high infant mortality. I mean, we joke about it, but it was a serious subject. There was a high infant mortality in that particular region. So children or infants weren't being registered at birth until they were 7 or 8 years old. But even so, I mean, I do recall those Brian Robson press conferences with bemusement when everyone knew there was a big elephant in the room, that nobody wanted to talk about that being Kanu's age. Now, Rhys, Cardiff.
Yeah.
Cardiff. Dave Jones was manager, I seem to recall, wasn't he, at this point?
He was, yeah. Dave Jones was there for a while. He was very much the nearly man of a team of nearly men. There was a great style of play. There were some young up-and-coming players. I think they overreached a little. I think things went wrong a little bit trying to sign players like Robbie Fowler and Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank. In truth, I think Cardiff were always more successful with players like Boothroyd and Chopra. But yeah, I think he carried the can for that team, the team of nearly men. But I remember it fondly, honestly, to watch. They were great. After that came Marky Mackay. He was very, very pragmatic. Then you've got, you know, the Vizitan's ownership and the switch to the rebrand of the club, the switch to red shirts. And yeah, I think everything was a lot more fun. Even though we were ambitious and, you know, maybe we overreached slightly, and there's a sense of frustration of always missing out on that extra step to the Premier League. But, you know, sometimes it ain't always what it's cracked up to be, boys. Sometimes being one of the better teams in the Championship is a lot more fun. Also, to go back to your TalkSport point, I find that ridiculous that people would say this is a non-glamour tie, and that's a bad thing. Like, modern days, I would say, if you look at Man City and Man United, they're probably in the FA Cup final because they have the best or the biggest squads, because most teams in the Premier League outside the top six can't be bothered for the FA Cup. It's an inconvenience to stay to their general objective to stay in the league. So they don't have a second team of any quality to put out, whereas Man City do. So that's why Man City wins the League Cup every year. So the idea that Cardiff and Portsmouth, you know, may even have been West Brom or Barnsley, could have made that final. For me, there's a romance to that. And, you know, they can sneer all they want. They can look down the noses from TalkSport. But I found it a refreshing time.
Absolutely. And Mike Parry, the guy I mentioned, is, of course, a big Everton fan, which, Dave, brings us very conveniently onto your particular choice. Tell us about the next cup final you'll be talking about.
It's the 1968 cup final. West Brom 1, Everton 0. I'm not picking it because West Brom won, because basically it's one of the worst finals of all time. There's absolutely nothing of any great moment happened in that final, other than Jeff Astle scoring from 20-odd yards 3 or 4 minutes into extra time to win the cup. The reason I picked this is if 1953 was the Matthews final, then 1968 should be the Lovett final, Graham Lovett, who played for West Brom, because it's an amazing story. He was a young player who'd come through the ranks at West Brom. He played in the League Cup final in 66, and there was big things expected of him. Loose talk in the Black Country that he was another Duncan Edwards, you know, which was perhaps pushing it a bit too much. But anyway, he was expected to go on and achieve all sorts of stuff, play for England, all that kind of thing. I think he was 19 in 1966, Christmas Eve 1966. He was travelling along the early version of the M1 late at night, lost control of the car, and it rolled down the embankment. And he was stuck in the car for hours and hours until he was eventually spotted by somebody driving past, and he was rescued. He woke up in hospital. His neck was chained back. He could only look at the ceiling. He couldn't move. He was paralysed at that point. They put him in traction to stabilise him, and he'd got a band around his neck, a collar under his head, stretching the vertebrae. He was in all kinds of trouble. And this was Christmas of 66. So gradually he started to make a recovery of sorts, and he left hospital in spring 67, sort of March, April 67. And he was hoping he would come back and play some football again. Went to a few games for the club, and they sent him off to watch games and scout for the club, just to keep him involved, really. He started to get some pain in his shoulder in the April, and they sent him back to the club surgeon and then to the hospital. Basically, they x-rayed him, and the doctor said, "You'll never play again. They've cleared the vertebrae." And the doctor said, if you were to do something as simple as miss a step on a stair, it could go back and you'd be paralysed. So obviously playing football was out of the question. So he said, is there any alternative to this? And he was told they could operate, but it would be 50-50. You know, it wouldn't kill him, but if it went wrong, he would be totally paralysed. And if it went right, he'd get 85% movement back in his neck. So in the end, he decided that he was going to have the operation, because he wanted to play football again. Even if he didn't play league football, it would mean he could play at some level. And, you know, even if he had a fall, without the operation, he could end up paralysed. So he was adamant that he was going to have this operation. So we went back into hospital in April 67. And he was in hospital on cup final day in 67. And a friend of the family came to visit him in hospital. And they watched the cup final in the hospital on television together. And this chap said to him, Oh, don't worry, Graham. This time next year, you'll be there at Wembley. And of course, it was just a nice, pleasant thing to say to him. But as it happened, it turned out he was right. Because he made his comeback Boxing Day 67, a year and 2 days after the crash. And gradually started to play some football again, mainly as a sub. And he wasn't really in the running for the cup final. There was a guy called Kenny Stevens who played on the right wing for Albion at that point. And he played a game, he played in the semi-final, and then he disappeared. He just disappeared. Nobody's really been able to quite work out what happened to him. But he just went home at that weekend and never came back. Lovett came into play in the team against Manchester United, played well about 3 weeks before the cup final and put himself in the running. So he came to the cup final week, and the Albion team at that stage picked itself, except for it was going to play on the right side of midfield, because they kind of played 4-5-1 after a fashion. At that stage, we just had Jeff Astle on his own up front. It was Graham Lovett, Kenny Stevens, who had come back but wasn't obviously in the manager's good books at this stage, or a winger called Dick Criswicki. Chris will put me right on that pronunciation in a few moments, but anyway, that's how we used to call him. And in the end, they decided, Alan Ashman, who was the Albion manager, decided that that Graham Lovett was going to do the job because he was a better defensive player. And Everton had got Ray Wilson, who played in the World Cup final, at left back, and he was a good attacking fullback, and they wanted somebody to stop him. So Lovett ended up playing in the FA Cup final a year on from being in his hospital bed. He ended up getting a cup in his middle. He almost made it better than that, because he almost scored in the last minute. Albion had a breakaway in the last minute of extra time, and Tony Brown was belting forward with the ball, and Graham Lovett thought, "Oh Christ, I better show willing and try and keep up with him." So he comes running up the pitch behind him, and Tony Brown apparently was going to pass the ball, which is hard to believe because Tony Brown never passed the ball when he was anywhere near goal. But anyway, Graham Lovett's catching up with him, and he screamed at Tony Brown, "Don't give it me." But he did. He passed it to him, and Graham said, "I closed my eyes, hit it, and waited for the roar." Of course, he went about 30 yards over the bar and into the crowd. But he got himself an FA Cup winner's medal. But the FA Cup hadn't finished with Graham, because this is the even more bizarre story. The following year, Albion got to the FA Cup semi-final again. They were playing Leicester. And Leicester at that point were getting relegated. Nothing much changes. And Albion's players were on £1,000 a man to win the cup, to win the semi-final and get to the cup final, which in those days was a monumental amount of money. So they drew Leicester, and Graham got a bit carried away with himself. He went to Bristol Street Motors in Birmingham. And a Cortina was the car that everybody wanted at that point. And he said to the salesman, "I'll play for West Brom. We've got Leicester in the cup on Saturday. And when we win, I'm going to get £1,000, so I'll have that car." So the salesman stuck the sold sticker on it. Of course, Albion lost the semi-final. So on the Monday, he had to go back into the showroom, and the salesman says, "Don't worry, Graham, I saw the results. I've cancelled your car." Albion went on tour that summer to America. Came back at the start of June, and Graham had got this huge, great Rover at the time. And he got into his car to head home after the tour. And he was driving through Quinton near Birmingham, and a bus driver coming the opposite way lost control of the bus. The bus ploughed into the Rover, took it back 60 yards, and Graham was in the car for 8 hours before the emergency services could cut him out of the whole thing. And there was a court case after it to do with compensation and all that kind of stuff. And there was a professor on road safety came in to give evidence. And he said if he'd been in any other car than a Rover, he'd be dead, because it was the Rover that saved him. So if Albion had won that semi-final and Graham had had that Cortina, it'd have killed him. So not only did he get to win the FA Cup, the FA Cup saved his life. Now, if you can't think that that's the best competition in the world, there's something wrong with you.
It beats your cup final songs with Chas and Dave and your new spangly suit, doesn't it? I mean, Reece, I should have asked you about the rectangular flags earlier, but after that story, I'm not sure. Can a rectangular flag or a triangular flag save a man's life? I don't know. I'm not going to be critical of the Ford Cortina because they were beautiful cars, but it goes to show that what this competition, the stories it can throw up, and we as people who write and like to express ourselves through the written word have got such a brilliant portfolio of case studies here to deal with.
Absolutely. Beautifully told there, Dave.
Thank you.
I really, really engaged there. I could picture in every aspect of that. And you can't do that with a fourth place finish.
Exactly.
I mean, you can tell a story of an FA Cup final. You cannot tell the story of when some team finished fourth. And I think we need to remember that just from a perspective of fans. These moments we were alluding to earlier that we should, you know, the season should always have a crescendo, have a showpiece. And yeah, absolutely agree with you. Be that the European Cup final, if your team is involved in it, or if it's the FA Cup final on domestic terms, you know, there's no comparison with that from a storytelling point of view. You know, a 38-game season that ends with you finishing fourth, which is great for the finances of the football club, and obviously that's important. But you don't write songs about it. You know, Chaz and Dave would never record a song for that. That's why we have the FA Cup final songs. And of course, there's always going to be there's always a place for that. It's just romantics, you know.
And Dave, before we move on, just finally, you mentioned the first live cup final earlier. This was, of course, the first colourised FA Cup final, if I'm correct. Is that right?
Yeah, it's the first coloured cup final. And it managed to capture a black and white game, unfortunately, because it was one of the most colourless cup finals there had been. It was dreary. I say that as an Albion supporter, and we won. But it was a remarkably dreary football match. But yeah, it was Princess Alexandra, wasn't it? I think it was the royal guest on the day, and she was told to wear something very colourful. So she put on a fancy red coat, and they couldn't work out why the Everton supporters were booing her as she was being introduced to the players. So somebody ended up in the tower after that.
Yes, absolutely. Not the best advice to give a member of the royal family when Everton are playing. Now, we talk about Everton. I'm gonna mention another cup final. It's not a good day for Everton, all of this. But an FA Cup final that means a little bit to me, because I think it probably stoked my interest in football. It wasn't a great final. But as I said earlier, cup finals, if they're not great games, they should be a platform for a great story. And this was a great story, this particular cup final. 1985, Manchester United 1, Everton 0. And Everton were absolutely powering their way through football. They'd come from nowhere under Howard Kendall to suddenly being the dominant force in English football. And they'd won the league title, won the cup, Winners' Cup, playing a fairly dismal, I think it was Rapid Vienna. They beat them 4-1 or 4-0. 4-1, I think it was, in Rotterdam. And this was going to be the treble. Manchester United had finished fourth. They were okay. But they didn't really challenge Everton at all that season. It had been a two-horse race with Liverpool, as usual. And indeed, Everton had actually beaten United 5-0 at Goodison Park earlier that year in a performance that Joe Mercer described as like watching Brazil wearing blue shirts. It was that good. So everyone was expecting Everton to clinch this unusual treble of two domestic trophies and a European trophy. Enter Mr. Peter Willis. Mr. Peter Willis was the referee on this occasion. He was also a police constable, maybe higher up the ranks. It was also his final game of his career as a referee. And of course, the big danger in that is that you might get a referee who wants to leave out or leave on a high or leave with their name in lights. And that's exactly what happened in this particular game. Now, it was a baking hot day. It was the first cup final that I watched from start to finish, utterly mesmerised as a nine-year-old lad who had grown up loving football, but hadn't had maybe a bit too young to watch games from start to finish. This one I watched from start to finish. It wasn't a great cup final, but it exploded into life when an increasingly weary Everton team broke from the middle. Peter Reid, of all players, broke down the centre of the pitch and Kevin Moreland brought him down. Now, these days, it would look like a red card automatically. It looked like a denying of an obvious goal-scoring opportunity. Back then, the rules were less clear-cut. It wasn't as black and white as that. Peter Willis ran over, and of course, this was the era. There was a strange era in the mid-80s where referees didn't give cards. And if you were a journalist trying to cover a match, you had no idea if somebody had been booked or not. And if somebody was sent off, they would merely point to the tunnel. And Peter Willis pointed to the tunnel to effectively deliver the first sending off of a cup final, FA Cup final. And it looked game over. Kevin Moran marched off the pitch disconsolately. Frank Stapleton was told to go and babysit the defence, having played up front. And effectively, United were down to 10 men and trying to see out the game to get a replay. Enter Mark Hughes, who we've mentioned before, Reece, a brilliant, brilliant technician, played this fantastic ball through to Norman Whiteside. Norman Whiteside, by this point, by his own admission, was ready to lie down and fall asleep. He was so knackered in the sapping heat. And he spotted that Pat Van Den Hoe, the Everton defender, had just created a shield, a wall, between himself, Neville Southall, and the far post. And he deliberately hooked the ball right around Van Den Hoe into Neville Southall's bottom corner. 1-0. Manchester United held on to win a fairly average final, 1-0. Ruined the story. But after the game, it was all about one man, Peter Willis. Dave, any memories of this particular match at all?
It is one of the great cup final goals, I think. That
it is, absolutely, yeah.
It is a fantastic goal. I always took against Norman Whiteside because I remember when he made his debut for Manchester United, I think it was at Brighton at the end of probably the 82 season, was it, just before the World Cup? And he came on and John Motson announced, and he is Norman Whiteside, who is 17 years old this week or something. And it was the first time that a footballer had been younger than me, and I realised I was never going to be a professional footballer. Well, I always held that against Norman Whiteside. But that was a spectacularly good goal. I mean, it was one of those ones where you've... Because that was such a good Everton side. And they... froze is probably too strong a word, but I think the pressure got to them of the enormity of the occasion. I mean, never mind the trouble. If they'd done the double of League and Cup, they'd have got there before Liverpool, which is a huge thing for them. And they never really got going that day. And that is, that is the one drawback of having the FA Cup final when it is played. The early May, it always seemed to be a pretty hot day for the Cup final, English football teams being the way that they were in those days. Don't necessarily enjoy playing in the heat. And that sometimes spoiled the occasion. Maybe Everton had just, hit the wall of playing so many games in that season with the European campaign and all of that as well. But they didn't live up to the occasion. Manchester United were able to do enough to see it through. I mean, it was a goal worthy winning an FA Cup final. But it's one of those ones where it just feels like the wrong team won, because that Everton team should have scooped a lot that year. I mean, they were, and I think had it not been for the Heysel ban and all of that, I'm sure they would have gone on the European Cup the following season.
Reece, as somebody probably too young to remember that great Everton team, it must be a strange concept to hear two older people like myself and Dave talking about there being a second Merseyside team that was as good as, if not better, than Liverpool.
Yeah, year before I was born. I think due to the Welsh influence in that Everton side, the kind of the folklore of it has been folklore being passed down. It wasn't the times of Tolkien was writing, but it does feel like an odd time, because just looking at it, 10 years previous was Tommy Doherty's Man United when they were relegated then promoted. They're a very different side. 5 years later is Italia 90, which is arguably, the genesis of the gentrification of football. And it seems like 1975 seems like far further back than 10 years. And then Italia 90 seems so far in the distance from 1985. And I think it's, a lot of it's down to what Dave says, that the Heysel disaster, the Bradford City fire, the same season, such a dark time for football. you know, gentrification as we know it, you know, that comes with this downfalls, but that, it does seem like such a long way away. And Everton being at the peak of probably of their history there as the best team, with Liverpool probably the second best team of the era. You know, they were the top dogs in a very dark time. And I feel desperately sorry for them, to be honest. And I think the bitterness they must have felt that through no fault of their own, they wouldn't have played in the European Cup the following season, and it would be years until English clubs would return. It's just a really, really unfortunate situation all around.
Indeed, it was. And you know, you can look at the carve-up of that particular Everton team. Probably more damaging to Everton, the Heysel Band, than any other club at that point. I know that Coventry and Wimbledon and Norwich and Luton were all denied European places for winning FA Cup or League Cups. But it felt like Everton had the entire backbone of their team hooked out over, well, not overnight maybe, but certainly within a year of Heysel happening. Dave, that particular Everton team featured a goalkeeper, Neville Southall, who in this particular year won, I think, Footballer of the Year, or certainly around that period. How good was he? And how unusual was it, more so, to see him beaten by a goal like that?
I mean, again, you know, you're talking about Mark Hughes being underrated. I think the same's true of Neville Southall. You know, I mean, we talk about the era of Gordon Banks, and then people move on to Peter Shilton, and then, you know, they'll move on to, I suppose, Peter Schmeichel and David Seamans. And there's a sort of a skip in between that, you know, that period. But Neville Southall, unbelievable goalkeeper. I mean, he's fit to be mentioned with any of the great goalkeepers, you know, with Gordon. I mean, my favourite goalkeeper of all time would be Pat Jennings. I think he was perhaps the best. And Neville Southall is easily worth mentioning in the same breath as Pat Jennings. You know, it was a great period for British goalkeepers through that 70s and 80s period. But Southall, we did an Everton game earlier on in this series. I can't remember who it was against. But, you know, watching the highlights on it, he was just unbeatable. You couldn't get the thing past him. It didn't matter what you were going to do. Neville Southall was going to save it. And, absolutely one of the best British goalkeepers. They've been one of the best goalkeepers ever been in the world, I think, without any exaggeration. Marvellous goalkeeper, and the foundation of that Everton team. I mean, you know, if you've got a goalkeeper like that, in the same way that United had Schmeichel or, you know, whoever else you want to mention in that same breath, it must be such a lift for the team, because you go out thinking, well, he's not going to let anything in, so we've only got to score one goal and we're away, you know. I mean, that must be such a great feeling going out on the pitch. And Southall was definitely one of those kind of goalkeepers.
And Reece, just finally, at the opposite end of the spectrum, a strange day for Kevin Moran, the first footballer to be sent off in an FA Cup final, and yet he ended the day as a winner.
Yeah, he is incandescent about that red card as well. That is like John Aldridge USA levels of anger. And obviously modern sensibilities watching it. I thought, I watched it with the sound off as well, because I was too young for the game. And I assumed it was yellow. And then which made me think, bloody hell, what do you need to do to get sent off? And then, like you're saying, that weird quirk I didn't realise about not showing cards, piecing together that he was sent off. And then, yeah, I couldn't believe how angry he was and how incredulous he found it. It's just it's a nailed on red, isn't it? But yeah, they managed to weather that storm and get the win. So mixed, well, I would say mixed emotions, but I doubt in the long term he's got the medal, so get out of jail free.
He didn't get brilliant. A medal on the day, though, did he?
He didn't get a medal on the day,
to go and collect it.
No, he had to, he went up and got sent away with a flea in his ear. So listen, gents, on that note, I think it's time we went and joined Stanley Matthews, Kevin Moran, and indeed all the other cup winners in the bath. I shall see you in the winner's enclosure shortly. Thank you ever so much for listening. This has been These Football Times. Speak to you soon.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.